Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So far, we've had companies being too big to fail and too big to succeed. Today, we've got just plain big. The verdict is out, though, on whether or not it's going to work. There was a big merger in money management today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice, over 10,000 independent insurance agencies across America committed to treating customers as people, not policies, online at trustedchoice.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Friday. It is the 12th of June today, everybody. Juggernaut is not a word you want to use lightly when you're talking about something economic, but that does seem a pretty fair description of what happened in the world of asset management today. This morning, the fund manager BlackRock reached a deal to buy up Barclays Global Investors. Nothing really remarkable so far. Deals happen all the time, of course. But this one is going to form a company that controls $2.7 trillion in assets. That is more, by the by, than the Federal Reserve does. And needless to say, once the deal closes, BlackRock will be the biggest money manager on the planet. Still, some of you may be asking, BlackRock who? Marketplace's Amy Scott has the answers now from New York.
BlackRock mostly invests money on behalf of pension funds, endowments, and other money managers. So it's not exactly a household name. Industry consultant Joff Bobroff says that could change.
BGI and our friends at BlackRock were relatively equals in size. By combining themselves, they will become head over heels over anyone else in terms of the size of the organization.
The merger will give BlackRock more access to small investors. Barclays is a big provider of exchange-traded funds. Those are increasingly popular investments that track the returns of stock indices or commodities. BlackRock started 21 years ago as a one-room, two-phone investment shop in New York. But in the last few years, its power has grown as it's gobbled up competitors. The Federal Reserve hired BlackRock to manage bad assets from AIG and Bear Stearns. Dushant Sharawat follows the money management business at Tower Group. He says it's a tough time in the industry. BlackRock's profits fell 65% last quarter.
Coming out of this environment, I think investors are going to take out their money out of under the mattresses or out of money market funds or the checking accounts and deploy more money into traditional money management firms like the ones we've been talking about.
Sharawat says the new firm's size could help it ride out the recession, but it may also draw scrutiny from antitrust regulators in the U.S. and Europe. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Oil prices slid today. Traders took profits from crude, hitting eight-month highs yesterday. But the real energy news of the day is coal, clean coal to be precise. This morning, the Department of Energy said it's going to restart efforts to build an advanced technology coal plant, a plant that was killed by the Bush administration. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
It's called FutureGen, and it would be the first commercial-scale coal plant in the world to trap and store its CO2 emissions underground. The Department of Energy today promised a little more than $1 billion in stimulus money to move the project forward. It's a victory for FutureGen Alliance. That's the group of coal companies and utilities backing the power plant. CEO Michael Mudd says government support is essential for clean coal's future.
Like with any technology, whether it's the first VCR, the first of a kind of an automobile, or the first of a kind of any technology, you got to build them, get the bugs out before you can have widespread acceptance by the marketplace.
Half of the nation's electricity comes from coal, so the stakes couldn't be any higher. It could also position U.S. companies to one day sell the technology to countries like China instead of the other way around. But George Paredes with the Natural Resources Defense Council says technology has nothing to do with clean coal's success or failure.
We already know that this can be done. The reason you haven't seen more of these projects is because there's no underlying economic driver to do this.
In other words, so long as pumping CO2 into the atmosphere is free, why would utilities pay extra to pump it underground? Paredes says absent a mandatory cap on carbon emissions, like the one now being considered in Congress, FutureGen's future won't be very bright. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
As you may have heard, six or 7,000 times, and more than a couple of those times right here, television stations have to make the switch from analog broadcast to digital today. You may also have heard about the possibility that some viewers will be left behind when the switch takes place. Screens may go dark even though Congress delayed the changeover by 4 months. But for the rest of us, the digital transition could be worth the wait, as Joel Rose reports.
All day, TV stations across the country have been flipping the switch from analog to digital. Here's what it sounded like on WTSP in Tampa Bay, Florida.
And right here, the man that's going to pull the switch, Ken, do the honors.
All right, here we go.
That's what you'd hear if you tried to watch over-the-air TV on an old set and you don't have a digital converter box yet. There are still about 15 million people who are getting their TV the old-fashioned way. No cable, just a handful of networks and a couple of other free channels. But once you get the box hooked up,
you will notice a much better picture and much better sound quality than ever before.
Joel Kelsey is an analyst with Consumers Union. He says digital TV also offers more choices, since each station can broadcast on several different channels at once. But Kelsey says some consumers may have trouble getting some channels.
With a digital broadcast, it's either all or nothing. You get the picture or you don't get the picture. So that's what people are calling the cliff effect.
Even if you don't have to do anything to your TV, you'll benefit from the digital switch. First Responders got a slice of the old analog spectrum for free. The government auctioned off the rest. Verizon and AT&T were the biggest spenders.
They're going to provide much fatter wireless broadband pipes, so consumers are going to be able to get much higher speed wireless broadband access.
But Forrester research analyst Charles Galvin says wireless companies won't be ready to begin offering service on that spectrum for at least 2 years. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders might as well have stayed home for all the movement there was on the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometime next week, the Obama administration is going to share its plans for making sure what's been happening to the financial industry never, ever happens again. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner will roll out the blueprints for a super regulator, a government agency that's supposed to spot systemic risk and head it off. Commentator Susan Lee got to wondering what kinds of people it might be good for that agency to hire.
Well, let's approach this question in the negative. For starters, not lobbyists or politicians. Neither group has the right prudential temperament or the right ethics. And lawyers are surely out of the running. Just look at the tons of lawyers at the SEC, none of whom were able to spot the current crisis until it was upon them. And probably not guys from Wall Street. Granted, there'll be lots of suits eager for a job, but hiring them would create almost instantly regulatory capture. That's the not uncommon event when regulators ignore the public interest to advance the interests of the folks they're regulating. It's unreasonable to expect a former Wall Streeter who has spent years denouncing regulation to change his or her spots. Come to think of it, super regulators can't be too young, or they'll have their cap set on a nice job in the financial industry when they leave public service. That's regulatory capture in the making. And they can't be too old, or the government will have to pay out the wazoo to match their giant salaries. Academic economists aren't good candidates either. They have big brains, sure, but they lack the nitty-gritty experience of trading markets or even recognizing accounting dodges. This leaves one more group of possibilities, bureaucrats. But this group can be disqualified on the grounds of proven incompetence. None of the bureaucrats belonging to dozens of public agencies were able to even identify one of the many causes of the current crisis. What's the net-net? There are no obviously attractive candidates to staff a super regulatory agency. In fact, this little exercise is a good demonstration of why the idea is a bad one. The job is impossible. And it will generate the worst of all worlds. We'll have a new regulator that will give the illusion of protection. And that illusion will create the optimum conditions for the next crisis.
Susan Lee is an economist living in New York City. You can send us your thoughts no matter where you live. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Amid all the headline economic news this week, banks repaying their bailout money and the White House weighing in on executive compensation, there was another threat out there. It's been burbling along for a couple of weeks now, showing up intermittently in the bond markets. That is the fear of inflation, that all this bailing out and pumping money into the economy is going to lead sooner rather than later to sharply rising prices. To help us out with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine with us. Also, John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Good to talk to you both again.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here, Kai.
I want to start with inflation this week and this prospect that seems to be out there that people are worried about rising prices at some point. And one of those people might be Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed. And Lee, let me get your take on whether or not this is real, whether we need to be thinking about this.
Well, you know, I think there is a bit of over-concern here. Consumer prices are actually, they're not really rising that much. They've risen less in the past year than in quite a long time in the U.S. and both globally. So it's hard to see inflation really taking hold. I think that some of this may be coming from a political standpoint. I mean, you know, people that are, you know, upset with all the spending that the government's doing, this is the rallying cry for those people. So we're seeing some of that.
Well, that's what's happening, right? The government is pumping huge amounts of money into the economy. The Federal Reserve is, you know, the phrase is printing money. That's not how they do it. But there's lots of liquidity out there, extra money. John, doesn't that eventually mean that inflation is going to hit us right in the pants?
It does mean that we have a very mild form of inflation already. It's not the kind that you see when you go to the checkout counter in the grocery store. But it means that the monetary base is already much larger than it's been. That hasn't spread out into the economy in part because the banks have been taking the money that they get from the government and putting it right back with the Federal Reserve. They're not lending it out in the way that will instantly cause price inflation, but the monetary base is much larger. And that's what part of what has Ben Bernanke concerned. So there's almost a meta fear of inflation.
Lee, if, as John says, these banks aren't putting that money into circulation, first of all, why aren't they doing that? I mean, are we still in a credit crisis?
Well, we're still feeling the effects of the credit crisis for sure. And they're not doing that because things are frozen. I mean, the banks haven't lent basically since this all started. You know, you could argue that, you know, some of the banks that have repaid all this TARP money maybe shouldn't have been allowed to do that since they haven't done what the whole point of all this was, which was start to lend again.
All right. So now you're scaring me here because this is the same conversation that the three of us had probably 8 or 9 months ago. John, are we back at square one or maybe we haven't really moved off?
I'm not sure we've really moved off. What we've done is been able to restore confidence that the banks aren't going to go out of business. But we've done that not by showing that the banks are doing business in a better way, but by showing that the government will step in and support them. That creates a weird dynamic where you still have banks that really haven't figured out how to run themselves properly yet. But now they're, you know, they can borrow money, they can raise capital, their stocks are going up. And so, you know, the incentives for improving their own behavior are being taken away. So we may actually be in a situation where things are worse than they were, say, a year ago, but we don't know it because there's so much government interaction in the markets.
Where do we go from here then? I mean, if the banks are giving back this money, they've got permission to do it, they're going to start next week. Where are we in this banking recovery that needs to happen, as Bernanke and the Secretary of the Treasury tell us, before anything else can happen? Lee?
Well, I think it's important that we're distinguishing here between the banking recovery and the rest of the economy's recovery, because the greater economy, we are seeing some positive signs there. But the banking system is a separate problem entirely. I think the big issue here is that the administration is sort of kissing goodbye a rare opportunity to sort of overhaul the industry. They're basically forfeiting the leverage that they could have over the banks to enact a lot of regulation.
John, have we wasted this crisis?
To a large extent, it appears that we are wasting the crisis more and more. Already the amount of regulatory reforms that were going to happen have been way pulled back. We were told that they were going to overthrow everything, you know, revamp the SEC, combine some of its functions with a few of the other regulators and have a whole new system. And already you have a couple months of the stock market doing well and getting some better consumer sentiment numbers. And it looks like the political will to have serious regulatory reforms has been completely sapped.
John Carney at ClusterStock.com. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai. We'll be right back.
Coming up, the race at Le Mans and Le Marketing.
Wealthy people attended, and people came from France and Germany, and you would see men in military uniforms on leave from base and TV cameras, and there's never been a moment in racing history that was that romantic.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a mixed bag for the markets today in English or in French. The Dow Industrials picked up a third of 1%, 28 points, closed at 8,799. The NASDAQ dipped a tenth percent, 3 points, finished at 1,858. The S&P 500 turned up a tenth percent, that is 1 point, ended the day at 946. For the week gone by, the Dow put on 0.4%. The NASDAQ was positive 0.5%. The S&P 500 picked up 0.7%. Financial stocks were looking up, especially Bank of America. It pumped up almost 6% today on news that it would repay all of its TARP money by early next year. Goldman Sachs took home a third of 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase chalked up a 0.5% gain. Wells Fargo banked nearly 2%. Steel lost some edge after Goldman Sachs said any potential boost from the stimulus package was already put into their stock prices. U.S. Steel melted down more than 6% today. AK Steel sheared off 5.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note retreated from this week's 8-month high, falling to 3.79%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders releases its monthly report on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. Leaders in the energy field are inducted into the Energy Efficiency Forum Hall of Fame at the Newseum in Washington. And the Paris International Air Show opens, celebrating 100 years of aviation history, showcasing new and vintage aircraft and an unmanned helicopter in flight. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So far this year, the U.S. trade imbalance with China, that is, how much more stuff we import from Beijing than we send over there, is almost $70 billion. That is down from the same stretch a year ago, thanks mostly to the recession. But still, it means there are a lot of cargo ships on their way over here, ships that are full of things Americans have decided they can't afford anymore. And that, in turn, is making American consumers very unpopular among Chinese manufacturers. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Yoshi Minamikawa owns a clothing factory in China. It exports to a high-end American department store and a U.S. men's retailer. He's long seen the U.S. as the economic major leagues, and not just in the export sector.
If Japanese director become famous, they will go to Hollywood. Everything, baseball players, scientists, everybody go to U.S.
But these days, Minamikawa is souring on American clients. He says they've been weaseling out of paying him. They call him up and they say this.
Sorry, this season we are selling no goods, so could you cancel? Oh my God.
He spoke at a recent trade fair in Shanghai. More than half of the dozen or so factory owners we talked to say they've added American retailers and big box stores to their bad guy list. Now, this perception may not be fair, but more export deals to the U.S. have gone sour. By one estimate, Chinese companies lost $150 million last year because of American contracts that fell through. That's more than double the figure from the previous year. Sometimes the made-in-China goods have already shipped by the time a customer reneges. In other cases, Chinese factories have the finished product, but they're stuck with it. So they call guys like David Dayton. His company, Silk Road International, can find another buyer in the States if the original party backs out. Dayton says he's a popular guy these days.
We're seeing a lot of factories that are sending us emails, photos, lists of containers of goods that says, we've got 5 containers of furniture that was supposed to go to a box store. They canceled the order. Would you like any of it?
These nightmares are making Chinese manufacturers more wary. A new survey from HSBC Bank found a significant increase in Chinese factories protecting themselves against shady deals. Some require more cash up front. Others ask buyers to submit what's called a letter of credit. It's a bank guarantee they'll pay on time. Essentially, the message is, we don't trust Westerners the way we once did. Can I see some ID, please? For the first time, factory owner Bian Xianping is buying export credit insurance. That gives him his money back if his buyer walks away from the deal.
The insurance company checks the financial background of the American customer. Then it insures us against default, up to $70,000. We're buying financial security.
We've, prior to this year, never heard of a Chinese factory doing due diligence.
Again, American importer David Dayton. He says it's not just U.S. traders who are getting a bad reputation in China. So is America's broader economic model.
The dollar hasn't been strong for a few years, and so Chinese companies don't want to do business in dollars anymore. So that takes you down a little bit of a notch. The recession, obviously led by whatever events transpired on Wall Street, that's taken everybody's perception of America down a notch.
And then there's swine flu. Point of origin, North America. So stay out.
They don't want their factory quarantined for 10 days just because an American showed up with a cough. All of those things, event by event by event, it's certainly changing the perception.
Some economists think this perception is an early tremor in a global rebalancing of power away from the West. Others think it's a more temporary thing. Either way, importers and exporters in China are waiting for the U.S. to recover its economic mojo. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you're a racing fan, there is plenty for you to do this weekend. NASCAR races, IndyCars, drag races, a little bit of everything. Or you could tune into a real race. The 24 Hours of Le Mans is this weekend over in France. It is one of the world's great races. Cars and their drivers have to have speed, not to mention the endurance, to last a full day on the race course. For car makers, it's a chance for worldwide bragging rights. And 40 years ago, it was an opportunity for Henry Ford II to turn his grandfather's company around. A.J. Baim writes about the race and Ford versus Ferrari in his new book, Go Like Hell. A.J., good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Let's set the stage here for a minute because, you know, today Le Mans is race car race. It's high profile and all that. But in the 50s and 60s, it was another order of magnitude.
It was probably the biggest single sporting event in the world at the time. By the end of 1966, it was a live broadcast, major, major event. There was no better marketing for a car company than to build the fastest, most technologically advanced racing car and win it the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
And here we have Henry Ford in the early to mid-1960s, Henry Ford II, taking over the company and really having to rescue it a little bit, wasn't he?
This quintessentially American empire was really backed into a corner, and they had the foresight to see that the future of the automobile business was in Europe, that this was the dawn of globalism. And so he invested wildly in conquering Europe. And the way to do that was to market your cars at the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
And tell me about the rivalry between Henry Ford II and Enzo Ferrari, because Ferrari was the dominant force in European racing at the time.
Two unimaginably larger-than-life figures. These two guys valued their companies and the companies that bore their name more than their own families. I mean, they lived and breathed those cars. Henry Ford II wanted to dominate Europe. He realized that in the 1960s, people wanted cars that were about style and speed and even danger. And nobody represented that more than the cars of Enzo Ferrari. So essentially, Ford sent a team over and tried to buy Ferrari. And the deal goes very sour. And it became apparent, I think, to many that Enzo Ferrari was just toying with Henry Ford II, that he'd never meant to make this deal in the first place, and he was just negotiating so that he could go and make a deal with Fiat, which, given what's going on with Fiat and Chrysler today, wow, who could see into the future? But Henry Ford II was spurned on a public stage, so this rivalry really became very intense, and it came to pit two entire continents against each other at the greatest automobile race in the world. I mean, who could script that?
Give us some sense of what it was like at these races back then. It's not like they had harnesses and roll cages and all the equipment that drivers have today. These guys were strapping themselves into the car with a seatbelt and wooden steering wheels and, to quote your title, going like hell.
Rivalry fuels innovation. two people want to beat each other, they're going to think really hard how they're going to do it. So at the beginning of the book, these guys are in these cars going 103 miles an hour down the Mulsanne Strait, the longest straight in racing. By the end of the book, they're going 225 miles an hour. These were very difficult cars to drive. It's incredible to think how primitive they were at the time. And yet, they were advanced. They had disc brakes. You know, Ferrari was fooling around with fuel injection, all this new technology that eventually filtered into the cars that we drive every day today. Now, there's another way to answer that question. What was it like for the spectator? The race was very much an affair. It was something that wealthy people attended, and people came from France and Germany, and you would see men in military uniforms on leave from base and TV cameras, and there's never been a moment in racing history that was that romantic.
But that romance, I mean, given the car industry today, it's a little bit sad, isn't it?
It is. It's very sad, but there's another way to look at it. The struggle for speed and glamour of the 1960s is translated to something different now. The struggle for the car technology of the future is very much the great industrial struggle of our time, and there's something terrifically fascinating about that, and I'm just excited for what we're going to see in the future.
A.J. Bame, he's an executive editor at Playboy magazine. His book about Ford and Ferrari and the Le Mans races of the mid-1960s is called Go Like Hell. A.J., thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, something to consider as you text away on your work-issued BlackBerry. It's entirely possible you didn't know this, but as far as the IRS is concerned, your personal use of a company cell phone is taxable income. Yeah, see, I knew you didn't know that. And the IRS, it knows you didn't know it, too, the tax code being complicated and all. So according to the Washington Post today, the government is working on a couple of ways to make it easier for you to pay those taxes. So now you know. Resume texting. But not before I tell you this. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 28 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ fell 3 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 added 1 point, a tenth of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. These days, jobs often define who we are. But 200 years ago, it was just work.
Work was something that people did, but it wasn't where they expected to put their center of meaning and their hope for a good life.
We will see you back here Monday afternoon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.